Boy, y'all sure are beautiful sitting out there tonight. It's great to be here. I would like to thank the committee for asking Sharon and I to come down and spend a weekend, because we had Rough River last weekend, and following up with this weekend has really just been super for us. And as you can tell this morning, Sharon really needed to get out and do this, and I appreciate her for sharing with us this morning. You know, I was concerned earlier in the week that I was not going to be able to do this, because Monday or Tuesday, I got my Rogaine and my Viagra mixed up, and I couldn't get my hair to lay down for most of the week. But it wore off. It wore off. But it is great to be here tonight. My hair is even laying down most of the time. You know, I do love this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I also love the program of Al-Anon, because as you can tell from Sharon's story this morning, we had a pretty tough road, and today we live a real comfortable, not trouble-free, but a comfortable life together. And from where we came from 17 years ago to where we are today, I would never have believed that would ever happen. The big book says that I'm to tell in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to try to do that in this next 3 hours as the best I can. So if you get tired of listening before I get tired of talking, you know, just go on and leave. That's okay. I heard a speaker at our tri-state convention in Evansville 2 weeks ago. And it was a guy named Sterling from out in Omaha, Nebraska. And he says, you know, we bring the whole package to the table with us when we start drinking. And, you know, I believe that. And hearing Sharon talk this morning, it reemphasized that a little bit more to me. Because she talked about her childhood being happy. And even though she lived in an alcoholic home, she had a pretty happy childhood. And when she would take a drink of alcohol, it didn't do for her what it did for me. Unlike Sharon, I was raised in an alcoholic home also. And I do not remember the good times. And I'm sure we had some good times, but I don't remember. Number one, we were poor. I didn't like that. I don't know why I felt like that was a reflection on me, but I did. We lived in an old house out in the country, had running water. If you had a bucket, you run out and get it. It also had outdoor facilities and all of the other things. And the deal was, everybody around us had the same thing, but it's almost like it was, you know, something pointed to me. I was the youngest of 9 kids. I didn't like that. Today I like it. There's only 3 of us left, and I hope to hell that the pecking order's right. You know, so I like being the youngest today, but at that time I didn't. I had brothers that were out doing things that I wanted to do, and I looked up to them, and I thought, man, if I could just be, you know, 5 years older, 10 years older. I had all of that. I think Mary called them the wannabes. I had all of that at a very early age. I did not want to be who I was. I wanted to be them. I did not want to have the family I had. I wanted somebody else's family. Didn't want to wear the clothes I wore because they were hand-me-downs. I wanted to wear good clothes, new clothes, all of this stuff. I brought all of this before I ever had the first drink of alcohol. You know, all of that was going on in my mind. And as a result, and I don't know whether I was 15 years old or 14 years old, and it's not really, doesn't really matter a whole lot today, but I was at a New Year's Eve party, I remember that, and there was a couple of guys there that ran around with my hero brother. He was 5 years older than I was. And I absolutely worshiped the ground he walked on. He would fight a buzzsaw, girls always hanging on to him and all that stuff. And I wanted to be just like that. And here I was, about 110 pounds, soaking wet at that time. You can't tell that by looking at me now. And I had, you know, acne all over and everything else. And I felt just the opposite of what I thought he was. But these two guys ran around with him, and they invited me that night to go out to the car with them, and I did. And I had a shot of Bourbon Deluxe whiskey. I remember what kind it was. And I only did that because I wanted their approval. Now, I want to tell you, that first taste of Bourbon Deluxe whiskey tasted terrible to me. I didn't like anything about it, except I wanted to get it down so that they could tell my brother that I could do these things. I went back in that party, and nothing had happened. And a few minutes later, they invited me to go out again, and I went out with them again, knowing that I hated the taste of that stuff. I didn't like the way it burnt my toenails or anything else. And I went out with them the second time for the same reason I went out there the first time. And I took another drink of that Bourbon Deluxe whiskey. And when I walked back in that house that night, alcohol performed the first of many miracles for me. Because that night, those little gals that I'd been afraid of, I was not afraid of them anymore. I could talk to them. I could dance with them. I could do all of those things that I'd only been able to fantasize up here about. And I said that night, I said, I'm not going to ever let this go. And for the next 24, 25 years, that's exactly what I did. I drank, and I believe from the bottom of my heart that I was at least mentally addicted to alcohol that night. Whether I was physically addicted makes no difference to me, because the physical addiction did not make me drink any more than the mental addiction did. I wanted what alcohol would do for me. I got sick that night and threw up and all of those things. And for the next 25 years, I would do that. But see, that was a small price to pay for those moments of feeling complete. And I know today when I listen to Sharon talk about that happy childhood and how the alcohol didn't do it for her, and it closed a hole in my gut that night, that I think that's what made me the alcoholic, is because it did something for me that very first night. From that very first time, I've never known what social drinking was. I always drank for the effect produced by alcohol, and that's the only reason I drank. And for a number of years, alcohol had its pluses as well as its minuses. And, you know, I had some little problems with alcohol in high school, kicked off the football team, expelled from school a few times. Those are minor deals to me. I didn't want to play their damn football game anyhow, and really I didn't. I got tired of them beating up on me, you know, and that's what they do. And that was when you're 110 pounds and you're out there and those other guys weigh 180, 190 pounds and they use you for the tackling dummy, you get real tired of it real quick. Now, I would have told you for a lot of years that I love football, and I like to watch it on TV, but I don't get hurt most of the time. I have been known to get hurt watching it on TV before, but most of the time I don't get hurt doing that. So it caused me a few little problems, but nothing of any major catastrophe. And as Sharon said, we started dating in high school, and believe it or not, I really did not run around with her crowd. They were just really stuck in the buds, and I didn't have any time for people that like to take books home from school with them. I threw mine out the window most of the time and stuff, and I didn't feel like education. The only thing I wanted out of high school at that time was me, and I worked and almost got out before my time. But anyhow, you know, I did my drinking in high school, and I've been to school drunk. You know, today, a lot of things that we did in high school back then, it was not really frowned on too bad. They frown on real bad today. So, anyhow, I did manage to graduate from high school, joined the United States Navy, and was in there for a period of time, and all I did was drink. That's all that was required of me, and that's all I did. Sharon and I started dating while we were in high school, and we continued to date when I got home, and one day I asked her to marry me. I thought that was the next right thing that I'm supposed to be doing, or the next thing. I don't know if it's the right thing or not. But by this time, see, I've already realized that alcohol is a problem for me. Now, I had not come to the point of wanting to give it up or anything else, but I was to the point by the time Sharon and I got married that I was looking for some way to be able to drink, however, something besides what I was doing. I wanted to be able to have a good time, feel comfortable, but not go through the blackouts and the passing out and that kind of stuff. And right before Sharon and I got married, I was working for a company, Pepsi-Cola, up in Louisville, driving a bottle route truck. And I can still remember driving around the hills of southern Indiana and thinking, now, as soon as we get married, you know, I'm going to settle down. I'll have my booze at home, and I'll drink a little bit at home. We'll go out a little bit, and everything's going to be fine. Now, I don't know where I get this idea from, because, my family, none of my family ever drank like that. My brothers didn't drink like that. My daddy sure as hell didn't drink like that. So I don't know where I got that idea from, but I guess it was because I watched Father Knows Best. You know, that's the way the TV families did things, and I guess I kind of fantasized that's what would happen with me. Well, needless to say, that did not happen. So we got married, and whenever my first daughter was born, that was the next thing that was going to change the way I was going to drink. And when Laurie was born, nothing changed. I did not know at that time that alcohol had a hold of me. I just felt like it was poor management. Maybe I just wanted to drink like that. I had 100 different reasons, but none of them was because I was an alcoholic. Now, as she said, her dad was an Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother, which some of you people here, I know Bob Juanita knows, knew Felix, and my brother by this time had been sober for 2 or 3, 4 years in AA. And so I knew, and I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous before, and I had seen, we used to run a country club, and Alcoholics Anonymous used to have a summer picnic out there. And so I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know that was where I should be at that time and where I would eventually end up. But anyhow, you know, the drinking just kept getting worse. And so in 1967, see, that's one of the things I have straightened out. She said we had a bad New Year's Eve, and that's the reason I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in July of 1967 that I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that because my big book is back in the room there that my brother gave me is dated July the 7th. So, but anyhow, it don't make any difference. It's okay. She has some blackouts too, so we'll forgive her. We'll forgive her. So, but anyhow, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I wanted to do a whole lot about my drinking. You know, I thought maybe if I could stay off of the booze for a little while, I could get a few dollars in my pocket and, you know, get some of the things that I kind of needed or wanted or whatever, and maybe I get her off my back. Because by this time, you can imagine she's not being exactly quiet all the time about my drinking, and she does not care for me coming home 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and she doesn't like to reach over there and feel the bed, and it's cold, and I'm standing there, and I say I'm getting up to go to work, and she knows because the bed's cold that I haven't been in it yet. So she was having a few problems with these things. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed around and probably didn't stay sober for 2 or 3 days at a time. I'm not sure. It really makes no difference. Now, if you're new here, my suggestion to you is do not do like I did, because eventually alcohol would just almost kill me before I was able to give it up. So anyhow, one day I get home from work, and she had been to Bowling Green, Kentucky that day to pick up her brother. He was in school at Western Kentucky University, and when I got home that night, she said, "Boy, I sure do wish you'd go to college." Well, I had barely got out of high school. I mean, just real barely got out of high school. But I said, "Well, we'll talk about it." And, you know, I thought that would drop. But she's one of these. She's tenacious. You know, she doesn't let a lot of things drop if it's on her mind. And she brought it up 2 or 3 more times. And so then she said something kind of magic. She said, "You know, if you went to school, I would work and help put you through school." And I'm thinking, college is 4 years. And if she's working and I'm not, that means I don't have to work for 4 years. And so I can pretty well have a do what I want to do. And so I said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. I believe I'll go to college. So off we go in 1967, and we pack everything we own, including all our belongings just about, and two kids by this time, and pack it all up, and we head for Bowling Green, and I start to college. I will say that college was a good experience for me. It was the very first time that I ever studied in my life. I had gone through 12 years of school and had never cracked a book. This time I did, and I did extremely well for the first probably 2 years into my junior year. I was Dean's List every time, President's Scholar, 4-point a couple times, 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, and was making real good grades. And I was studying continuously. And Sharon will tell you, I spent sometimes 40 hours a week sitting at our kitchen table studying. And things went along pretty good, and I was, you know, going along okay. And one day some guys come up to me and said, we'd like you to join our fraternity. And I said, well, sure, that sounds good. I'd never belonged to a fraternity before. I'd heard about them, and I knew some of the things that they did. And so fraternity life kind of sounded, you know, good for me. And so I agreed to join a fraternity. And if I'd had another semester or two of college, I'd have probably flunked out, because I went from studying all the time to fraternity-ing most of the time. And they liked to have me around because I was over 21, and a lot of them were not. Most of them were not. And so they didn't have to worry about getting somebody to buy their booze for them. Old Jerry can get it. So Jerry would go to the liquor store, and of course, I got included in everything. So I was, Bill Wilson, or Dr. Bob talks about being one of the leading spirits. I guess I was one of the leading spirits of our fraternity down there. And I drank, but I did manage to get through college and graduated in 1970. And this is where drinking took on the pattern it would take for the next 13 years. Because at this point, I became a daily drunk. Now, up to this time, you know, in college, you drink when you've got the money to do it. And before, I had drank probably 2, 3, 4 nights a week. I'm not sure how much. But at this point, when I graduated from college and went to work and was making decent money and was traveling. And see, when you travel, they give you an expense account. And I was drinking other people's money as well as all of ours. But, you know, I liked it. Number one, I was not at home. As Sharon said, I didn't hear much about being home. I was a bar drinker. I liked the women. I liked the music. I liked all of that bull that goes on in the bar. That was the place that I felt most comfortable. So as a result, when I started traveling and stuff, then I could be out there and be who I wanted to be, doing what I wanted to do. And this went on for the next 13 years. I worked for a large public accounting firm, and one of the requirements to be a CPA is to pass an exam, and it's a 2.5-day exam called a 5-part exam, and I never could pass that thing. I passed the 2 roughest parts the first time I took it 4 more times, and never could pass the other 2 parts of it. And so I saw the handwriting on the wall. I was not going to be able to stay with Pete Marwick, so a job opening came up in Evansville, Indiana, with a company that we were doing the audit for, and they asked me if I'd like to interview for it, and I said yes. And so I came down to Evansville and interviewed, and I liked Evansville. I had spent some time down there during this previous job doing an audit in a few places, and I really liked Evansville, because they had a lot of these quaint little country bars, Darmstadt Inn, Hornet's Nest, Hornville Tavern, St. Joe, St. Wendell, all of those. And I liked those places. And number one, one of the main reasons I liked those places is because her mommy and daddy were not there. That was 130 miles away, and I didn't have to go under the scrutiny of being around mom and dad and them knowing what was going on. So I took that job down there in 1973, and we moved down there, and that job lasted for 2.5 years. And they didn't know that they were hiring a drunk when they hired me. They thought they were hiring a controller for their company. And I'm an alcoholic. My first love is alcohol, and it takes precedent over everything. And I know that today. I didn't know that then. I thought that I would be able to do them a job and came down there with every intention of doing them a good job. But it was just not to be. So one day I saw my boss walking around up front, and he came back and said, I'd like to talk to you a few minutes after work. And so I thought that's kind of strange, but I waited around, and when I walked in his office, he said, you're fired. No explanation, but see, I didn't ask him, because I knew why I was fired. I knew about all of that company's money that I had spent on booze, because I had charge cards, and I traveled to Mexico and Italy and different places, and I spent a lot of their money. And I knew eventually that was going to catch up with me. And I think I really felt relief that day. You know, I didn't have to lie to those people anymore. I knew why they fired me. They didn't say, but I knew. And I didn't have to lie to them anymore. I didn't have to con them anymore. That was a done deal. Went home and was unemployed for about 6-7 weeks. I'm not sure how long. And they paid me for all of that. And I badmouthed them the whole time. I badmouthed them the whole time, and you know how they were inconsiderate and how I'd done them such a good job and all that stuff. And they were sending me a paycheck. They paid me for every week that I was unemployed. And they told me, if you have a job, trouble finding a job, we'll continue to pay you. That's pretty good. That's pretty understanding people. But see, I couldn't tell you that, because if I did, that would mean I was wrong. And boy, that's just not my vocabulary. But anyhow, I found another job, and that's when we started living apart. I went to work there in July of 1975, and I left Sharon and the kids in Evansville, and the company rented me an apartment, and as she said, I come home a couple of times. I'm not sure how many times, but I was working real hard, you understand, you know. And so I didn't have time to go home. I had a lot of time to go to Nashville, because that was about 110 miles away, and Nashville's a good party town, and Madisonville was dry. And so I like to go to Madisonville. Sometimes we stopped at Hopkinsville and didn't make it to Madisonville, but a lot of times we went to Nashville. And so that company tried everything under the sun to make me a success. They tried putting this square peg in this round hole and this square peg in this round hole, and nothing was working. And they sent me back to Evansville to open up a division for them over there. And by this time, Sharon was living in Madisonville. And I said, well, no, we can't pull the kids out of school because they're going to start in another month. And so I said, you know, you let them go on and I'll live up there and I'll come home. And, you know, the whole routine is just over and over again. And so I lived in Evansville and I ran around and played the big shot and single guy and all of this other stuff that alcoholism tends to let people do. And I lived up here, and when I got her back up here, within a year or so, they didn't have a position anymore for drunk on her payroll. And they let me go in December of 1981, and as you can imagine, there was not a whole lot of people beating my doors down looking for a drunk that week. And nobody was calling or anything. So I remember that a guy that I had worked with had gone to work for a company up in Louisville, and he had told me if I ever needed a job, come talk to him. And so I went up, and he convinced me that I could be successful as an agent for them down in Evansville. So I went down, and I didn't have anything else to do, so I went down and opened up my office. I had a real fine office. It was one of these hourly rental motels. You know, one of these, if you wanted a room for an hour, you know, that's all it took. You know, that's what you could get it for. And that was my room number 29. I drive past every once in a while just to have some of those old memories. And I get me a telephone and table and pad of paper, and I become an agent for a trucking company. And I thought that the first thing I needed to do was develop business. That's first thing, usually most people go in business thinking it's the ideal thing to do, develop business. So I decided that since I had call forwarding on my phone, that if I would forward the calls to the house, then Sharon could answer the calls in case somebody did call, and I would go out and find business. And so I forwarded the calls to the house, and I went to the Hacienda restaurant. Now, they have 16-ounce mugs of beer down there. They don't have the 12-ounce. They have 16. And they also have nachos. So I'd eat lunch and drink my beer and wait for a customer to come in. And not many came in. In fact, I'm not sure I ever got any customers out of there. But I wait, and I gave it a fair trial. I stayed in there quite a bit, and none came along. And you might imagine it was not real successful for that first few months, but I had a friendly banker. And this friendly banker was a sucker, is what he was, because he believed my lies. And I would go in and tell him how much money I needed, and at that time, I don't know if he still have them or not, but they have short-term, like 90-day notes and 6 months notes and 2 months notes and stuff. So I tell him, I need $3,000. What do you need it for? And I give him some reason. He'd say, okay, I'll prepare the papers. You come down and get them. Take them, get Sharon to sign them, and I'll give you money. So I would go down and get the papers, and I'd bring them back to my office, and I would forge Sharon's signature on it, and I would sign mine. And I go up there, and he'd say, you want me to put that in your checking account? And I say, no, I've got to pay cash for this. So he'd give me all this money in cash, and I go off till I spend it. And I drank up. When we got sober, or when I got sober and she got serene, yeah. we had to go down there, and there was $20,000 in these short-term notes that I had accumulated over about a year and a half or 2 year period. So, and most of that, some of it did go to pay bills, but I'm going to say 80% of it went to pay my bills at the bars. Because when I had lots of money, one of my favorite sayings used to be, got money hadn't spent yet. But then when I got sober, I found out I hadn't earned it yet either. So I would spend a lot of other people's money and just have a good time. And when I get this money, I just blow it. You know, I buy rounds of drinks. As she said, she would be deciding what to buy at a grocery store, and I'd be buying rounds of drinks for $100-$150 a time at the executive inn. And that's just the way I didn't know, you know, I guess that's alcoholism. I couldn't keep from doing that. As I've told you, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea how many times or anything else. But I woke up on the floor, sleeping on the floor at that office on July 13, 1982. And I called her up, and as she said this morning, she was the point at that point that she could not care. And I told her I was going to call Alcoholics Anonymous, and that did not impress her. She didn't say hoo-lee-loo or nothing else. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night. It was a Wednesday night. And they had a big group in Evansville called Seton Manor Group, and I went out there. And I started about 6 or 7 months, I'm not sure how long it was, that I became Mr. AA in Evansville. I was chairing meetings, I was cleaning ashtrays, I was speaking at meetings, I was doing everything except changing. All I did was I was dry, I was not drinking, and I stayed real busy. And I was running to 2 or 3 meetings a day, leaving my office. I even hired a girl to work for me so that I could make noon meetings. I was doing everything. But I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't read the steps, I didn't do the steps, I didn't do anything other than go to meetings. And as you might imagine, I heard a little gal from Georgia one time say, the same person will drink again. And I believe that from the bottom of my heart, because in January or February of 83, I headed to Louisville on business. And on the way up there, that little monkey jumps up on my shoulder and he said, boy, a drink sure would taste good. Maybe you're not an alcoholic. And I wrestled with that for that 100 miles to Louisville. And when I got up there, you know who won. Checked in a motel, got a double shot of Jack Daniel's whiskey, and that's probably the best drink of alcohol I've ever had, because that started me on a 5-month drunk that proved to me everything that you people have been saying over the years. Everything that I was not convinced of up until that point, that next 5 months, would convince me That hell that I went through that next 5 months would convince me that you folks were right. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what happened. So I started that 5 months, and as she said, I went through that treatment program in that 5 months, and I knew all the AA lingo, and I impressed those people. And man, these guys said, he is going to stay sober the rest of his life. Hell, I couldn't wait to get out to get a drink. But I said the things that I knew they wanted to say. But there was one old biddy up there, and her name was Mary. I still like Mary, though. But her name was Mary, and she had about 22 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she worked up there. And the day that I was to get out, she looked at me and she said, in group, she said, if I ran this place, you would not be getting out of here today. You are going to drink again. And, I mean, she just called me the fraud that I was. And she was right. And I really hated her guts for a long time because she did that to me. And I finally went up to her one night and I said, that's the best thing you could have ever done for me because you showed me the fraud that I was. But anyhow, I got out and got to drinking, and I decided then that since Sharon was keeping tabs on my drinking, as well as some other people, that I needed to open me up a second office where I could go during the week and drink and be an AA in Evansville on the weekends. You know, so I had this really figured out. So Terre Haute, Indiana was a good place, and so I convinced the company to let me open up an office up there. And this was not a very successful venture, I can assure you, because the second day I was up there, I was with one of the guys from the company, and I got drunk that night and made a complete fool out of myself and really, really made him mad. And the next morning I meet him for breakfast, and he told me that he had been on the phone from about 3 o'clock in the morning till I met him talking to our company up in Louisville about what they were going to do with me. And he said, they want you to get in your car and go back to Evansville, Indiana, and call when you get back there because they're going to have a meeting whether you're going to continue to represent them or not, and blah, blah, blah. So I get in my car, and the big book talks about that fear of impending doom. I know what that is because I live with that. It's only 95 miles from Terre Haute to Evansville, but it's 5 lifetimes, I can assure you. And between Terre Haute and a little town called Vincennes, which is halfway between the two, I was absolutely going crazy. So I pull into a hotel there and go in and call our office up in Louisville. And I asked them, you know, I said, I've got to know what's going to go on. And they said, we don't know yet. We haven't had our meeting. Go on home and call us. I hung up the phone, waited for a few minutes, what seemed like a few minutes, probably 30 seconds. And I called him back and I said, Rick, I said, I don't think I can make it home. I've got to know. And he said, Jerry, I can't tell you. And this is probably the most important time in my life to this day. Because I hung up the phone that morning. And I know that right there in the lobby of the Executive Inn in Vincennes, Indiana, is where I took the first step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't take it in a conventional way, but that morning I decided, standing there, that I was going to leave the hotel, and I was going to go to Evansville, get on an airplane, and go somewhere and drink myself to death. Now, that don't sound like that's taking the first step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But see, standing there, I knew I could not drink, but I also knew Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. Because I'd tried it. But that morning, I surrendered that alcohol was my master, and I was going to have to drink myself to death. As Sharon said, God did for her what she couldn't do for herself, and I think God did for me that morning what I could not do. Because when I got in that car and headed for that airport, instead of going to that airport, I went to my house. Now, why I did it, I still don't to this day know. But I did. And that started me on a journey into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got home, the company told me, they said, when you're sober, which I had been for about 6 or 7 months, they said, you're as good a guy as we've got. said, when you're drunk, you're of no use to us at all. Said, so we want you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we want you to go every day. And said, if we need to send somebody to help you run an office, we'll do it. But we want you at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And they said, and we want a telephone number of somebody that we can call to verify this. So when I have to sign those little papers that the court's saying and stuff, that don't bother me as long as they stay for the meeting. They've got to stay for my, I don't sign them until the meeting's over, so I make sure that they stay for the full meeting. But anyhow, that's exactly what they were doing for me. They were making me get my papers signed. And I went down, and not this Jim Christian, but the Jimmy Christian from Evansville was at meetings all the time, and he gave me his number and said it'd be okay for them to call. Man, every night I'd run up to him. I said, Jim, anybody call you? And he said, no, nobody's called. And this went on for 10 days, 2 weeks, or whatever. And I thought, I've given them the wrong number. So I call him up. You know, that fear is still there. And I call him the big Polack. This guy named Rick Ripkowski lives out in Beaverton, Oregon now. And Rick said, Jerry said, I've got that number. And whenever I get ready to call, I will call. And I was with him in Denver about 4 years ago. And he said, I've still got the number. Said, I'm still going to call one of these. I said, well, you better hurry up. Jim's dead, you know. So, but that did keep me going. At this time, you know, as I said, I'd never asked anybody to be my sponsor. And I still wasn't going to do that. But a guy walked up to me one day, probably within 2 days after I came back his time. He said, Jerry said, it's pretty apparent that you're too arrogant, too hard-headed to get a sponsor. So he said, I'm your sponsor. And said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And he'd always tried being a friend before, and that hadn't worked. So he said, I'm going to be your sponsor. I'll always be grateful for Jess. Jess doesn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. But when I needed Jess, he was there. And he was single, and he went to meetings every day. And he led me into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'm not a teacher. He said, I will show you how I live this program in my life. And that's exactly what he did. We went to meetings. We had a great time together. We went camping together. But he showed me how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked in his life. And I'll always be grateful for that. He was not a tough sponsor. He wasn't one to demean me or anything else. He said, if you want what these people have, you do what they do. And he said, watch these guys. And you take these things home with you, and you try them at home. And, you know, it worked. For some years now, life has been pretty good in our household. Sharon said, you know, Jack Sullivan used to always say, you know, when you dance, you got to pay the fiddler. And I had to start paying that fiddler. Business went bad, as Sharon said, and we got a lot of trouble with the IRS because I didn't make estimated payments, and when I filed my tax returns, I just signed it and said, don't have any money, I'll send it to you when I get it. And they didn't particularly like it after a while. And they called me, and everything really seemed to go to hell, but it didn't. Things got tough. But you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works real well when everything's going good. I found out the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works even better when things are going bad. Because what seemed like the worst time in our life is when that little lady and I became good friends, and we became lovers, and we started traveling. Well, we didn't start traveling at that time, but we started doing things together, and we started being happy with each other. And that was a real difference in what our life had been up to that point. You know, this is a family disease, and as Sharon says, as far as I know, none of my kids are affected by alcohol. I mean, are alcoholics. I'm sure they've all been affected by it. But I like to talk about my family because they're a great pride to me. I'm very proud that I have kids, as she says, will come and talk to me and we will discuss things. This is not always the way it's been. That oldest daughter's never lived in our home other than short periods of time with Daddy sober. She left in August of 1983 to go to college, and I just got sober in July. So She never lived in that house, but when she would come home, she saw a difference in our house. And when she was in college, she even wrote a paper. She went to some AA and Al-Anon meetings and wrote a paper that won an award about alcoholism. And she asked before she did, she says, okay, if I do this. And I said, yeah, whatever you want to do. And she let me read it. And I knew then how much my drinking affected her, because she talked about not being able to be herself at parties. You know, she couldn't have fun. She was always constantly worried about what had happened if she got drunk, you know, and all of this stuff. And I realized then that I had put a real fear in her, and that's a real shame that you rob a child of their childhood by doing that. But that's exactly what I did. But you know, today, I guess it's been probably 5 years ago when Courtney was, well, no, when Kyle was a baby. She's got two of my three grandkids out in Kansas City. And at the time, she worked for the NCAA, and she had to be up at Indianapolis to the Final Four. And she had two kids, and her husband was working one of the regionals or working somewhere else. And she needed somebody to babysit. And Sharon's working, and I'm semi-retired, and she needed somebody to keep those two kids. And, you know, she allowed me to keep her two most prized possessions. I changed more diapers than I ever have with my four. You know, I changed diapers. I did a whole bit. I took them to the playgrounds and played and stuff, and absolutely loved having them with me. That is a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's the gal that did not want to leave to go to college because she was afraid her mama would not handle me. And she wanted to give up her career, anything she wanted, to help protect her mother. So, yeah, you think I love this program. You're dang right I do. I've got a son that's 32. Is that right? And he and I could not be in the same room together. The hair would raise. We're just like two dogs. You know, we'd get ready to fight. In high school, I had to throw him out a couple of times. He left a couple of times. When he graduated from high school, he just wanted to get away from me. So he chose the easier, softer way. He joined the Marine Corps. And he went off the Marine Corps for 4 years. And I would like to think that I know he changed some. And I like to think that I changed some. He came back and said, Dan, I want to go to college. And so I said, I'll help you. And so he goes off to Western Kentucky. And he goes to college. And probably in his junior year, deciding what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said, Dad, said, you've got a pretty good business there. I said, I wonder if maybe when I graduate from college, if you might consider me coming to work for you. And that scared the heck out of me. You know, here, he and I had never been able to get along. And I said, well, let's talk about it. And I've got some friends in the program, and I talked to Bob, and I talked to some other people about having kids working in your business with you and stuff. And I got enough assurance that if we did things right, that it would work. So he graduated from college, and 7 years ago, I guess 7 years ago this December, Michael started work for me. And he used to work for me, now he works instead of me. I don't go in much, and they're happy. My other son now works there, and they're happy if I don't go in, and I am too. So we've got a pretty good deal going there. And come January the 1st of this 2001, they're going to take over the business. But, you know, this is all gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. When things got tough, I had people that I could go to and talk to and share with, and they would share with me, and they would let me think things through, and they would share their experience, strength, and hope. Would never, ever have been able to do that without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was one of those that I reacted. I didn't act, I reacted. One of my regrets is that my mother died in 1976, never having seen me sober. I was drunk the night before she died. My One of my brothers and I went out and got drunk, and I was so hungover the next morning when she did die that I was not really of any use to anybody. And in the process of my making amends to people, you know, I did the amends the way it was suggested that I do for my mother. And that didn't seem to work. I still had a gnawing feeling in my gut that there was something else that I needed to do to make amends to my mother. And see, I was the youngest of nine kids. My mother was 40-something years old when I was born. And I think really it wasn't my mother as much as I didn't like old people. I just thought, you know, I'll shoot them, get them out of their misery, and get rid of them. It's kind of my philosophy. And I really, I treated my mother very bad for a number of years. And so I was at a conference up at Clifty Falls, Indiana, and Burns Brady was talking up there that weekend, and I talked to him, and I told him about that feeling that I had. I said, you know, I've done what I've been asked to do, but it just hadn't felt right. And he said, well, don't worry about it. I said, something will come along. I said, just be open to doing something. Well, I had a guy with me that weekend that was probably 78, 79 years old at the time. And right after we got back, he got sick. And for the next 3 or 4 years, I was able to be what Al needed. When I put him in a nursing home, he didn't have any family of his own other than a couple of nieces and nephews and a brother. And he had never been married, or he had been married one time of years and years ago. So he didn't have any kids of his own. So I was his wheels, and I would take him to, if he felt like going to meetings, I'd take him to meetings, I'd stop by. He loved cheese puffs. I'd stop and get his cheese puff for him. And I didn't like going to that nursing home. But I made a commitment that that's what I was going to do. And so for about 4 years, twice, three times a week, I went to the nursing home. And Al died right after Rough River 4 years ago, I guess it was. But that was a gift that God gave me to help me make amends to my mother and to finally lay that to rest. Since then, I was able to do the same thing with Jim Christian. I was able to be his sponsor and be with him for the last 2 years that he was alive, and help do the things for him. So the program's given me a lot of opportunities. I would like to think that it's changed me. I don't think really the program's changed me. I think God changed me by me being willing to do some actions in my life. We've had some great times. We've made some great friends. There's a lot of our real good friends here this weekend. And, you know, I love to go to these things because we meet new people. And about anywhere I go anymore, you know, if I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know somebody there. So, you know, it's one of the benefits of being around for a little while and getting to go to these things. I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this weekend. You could have got it a little bit warmer, but if I get snowed in, this is a good place to do it. You know, I would be truly grateful to be snowed in up here for a few days. But my life is good today only because God gave me a willingness a few years ago to do some things. And I think that was the key right there, is I had a willingness that I never had before. So I've been able to enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to hate some of the things I've had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's okay. When necessary, I liked them. It's just necessary, I do them. I always, and I will, till the day I die, I will give Jack Sullivan credit for the way I always end my lead. He used to tell a story, and several of you have heard it, I know, about the snake. And a guy's walking down the road, and it's real cold, about like it is up here on this mountain. And there's a poisonous snake laying alongside the road. And the snake looks up at the guy and says, "Mister," said, "would you pick me up? Because if you don't, I'm going to freeze and I'll die." And the guy says, "No, you're a poisonous snake," said, "you would bite me." And the snake said, "No, if you'll pick me up and warm me up, I will not bite you." Said, "Anybody that would do that for me, I could not do that to." So the guy thinks about it, and he puts the snake in his coat, and he walks on down the road a little bit. And the snake warms up. And when the snake warms up, it reaches up and bites the guy in the neck. And he throws it to the ground. And he said, "You promised me you would not bite me." And the snake looked at it and said, "But you knew what I was when you picked me up. And if I ever pick up a drink of alcohol, I know what it was when I picked it up." Thank you all very much.